Russia was taking on the role of Nazi Germany. The arguments made for the Russian invasion were practically identical to those that had been made by Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. Russia was simply acting to defend ethnic Russians. Despite having assurances that the United States would defend Ukraine if it agreed to denuclearize, when Russia seized its territory, the United States did nothing but impose sanctions and uselessly saber-rattle at the United Nations. It was 1938 all over again. By allowing Russia to invade Ukraine uncontested, America had emboldened Russia. With a revanchist president intent on returning his country to the power, influence, and territorial integrity of the days of the Soviet Union, Poland and the Baltic nations had every reason to worry that Russia wouldn't stop at Crimea. Not knowing if America or NATO would come to their aid only deepened that concern. If Russia invaded even just one of the Baltics and the Americans sat it out, that was it. Not only would it be the end of NATO, but Russia would have nothing further to hold it back. It would be the end of a free and democratic Poland. Poland would be Russia's next target. Harvath didn't have to do any more convincing. Sergin's rumor clearly made sense as far as Yashinsky was concerned. The fact that he and his team had been sent to Europe demonstrated how seriously the Americans were taking the threat. Avoiding a war by taking the fight to Russia before Russia could bring the fight to them made sense. What also made sense was Harvath's attitude that to do so might require operating outside the bounds of the law. Looking at him, she asked, "How are we going to stop Russia?" Harvath liked that she was using the word "we." "Our main focus has to be figuring out who's running the operation," he replied. "If we can uncover that, we can begin to take it all apart." "So what's our next move?" Glancing at Nicholas, he responded, "We're going to have to take another trip." "Where to?" "Gotland." "The island off Sweden?" she asked. He nodded. "Why? What's on Gotland?" Climbing down from the table, Nicholas shook his head and answered for him. "Trouble. Very serious trouble." Chapter 17. Kaliningrad. Colonel Oleg Tretyakov needed to get out of his office. It was stifling. Too many people, too many telephones ringing. He needed to think. He had relocated to Kaliningrad, the Russian exclave along the Baltic, 24 months ago in preparation for the invasion of neighboring Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. Of course, no one in his government would dare refer to it as an invasion. They were taking back territory they saw as rightfully theirs. Publicly, they planned on calling it a peacekeeping mission aimed at protecting ethnic Russians. It was a dubious term at best, as most of Central Europe was until the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s under Russian control and thereby still contained people of Russian lineage or ethnic Russians. The plan was simple and had worked for Russia before: foment dissent, encourage uprisings, and use their permanent position on the Security Council to defeat any vote for UN peacekeepers to be sent in. Instead, Russia would magnanimously offer to send in Russian Special Forces soldiers who would provide security until referendums could be held and political solutions arrived at. Of course, the referendums would be bogus, would break in Russia's favor, and the Russian government would use the so-called democratic results to justify officially annexing the Baltic states. To help create an environment of chaos, local intelligence assets, as well as useful idiots, were being paid, trained, and directed to create as much anarchy as possible. Their efforts were being amplified by legions of online trolls, armies of internet bots, and hordes of fake news sites, all of which were run out of a secret facility in the Russian city of St. Petersburg, called the Internet Research Agency. A GRU cyber espionage group called Fancy Bear rounded everything out. Fancy Bear hacked sensitive information and passed it on to the Internet Research Agency. The Internet Research Agency then used the information to create yet more fake news stories. Fellow travelers, also known as fifth columns, in the targeted countries acted like repeater stations, boosting anything and everything the Internet Research Agency and Fancy Bear put out. This basket of espionage and propaganda tactics was called special or hybrid warfare, and the Russians were masters of it. By the time NATO could realize what had happened, or could even respond, the Baltic states would already be lost. Tretyakov's job, though, was to make sure that if NATO did respond, that response would be as weak and ineffective as possible. This meant knowing as much as possible about NATO's operations. To do that, he had developed a vast network of spies, both inside and outside of the organization. The creation of the PRF anti-NATO terror organization had been his idea, and its cells hadn't been limited to just NATO countries. Cells had been created not only in nations that were currently considering membership, but in ones that might be sympathetic to NATO and provide staging to NATO forces or other strategic military support. Moscow considered it a clever plan. Diverting attention away from any Russian involvement by making the world believe the PRF was a genuine grassroots uprising across NATO was brilliant. There had been no equivocation. Moscow had made it crystal clear that Tretyakov's mission was of critical importance, and that importance was driven home by the size of his budget. In his decades in military intelligence, he had never seen anything like it. But with exceptional responsibility came exceptional accountability. News had broken about Norway. His superiors back at headquarters were not happy. They wanted a report. How was that PRF cell discovered? Did any of its members survive? Was there anything linking them to Russia? What did the Norwegian authorities know? What was the status of the other cells? What changes did he plan to make? They were overthinking it, reacting instead of acting. The truth was he didn't plan on changing anything, not without a good solid reason. The rest of the cells were still in place and ready. He didn't know how the Norwegian cell had been uncovered. He was just as confused and angry as his superiors were. Putting that cell together had taken a tremendous amount of work. Getting them into positions where they could be hired to service equipment in those caves had taken even more work. It had been a good plan, a solid plan. Something, though, had gone wrong. Someone had talked, or had slipped up somehow. And while the GRU had plenty of spies across Norway, the information was slow in coming in. Only a small piece of intelligence had made its way to him so far. At the last minute, just before the raid on the cell had been conducted, two investigators from NATO had been added to the assault team. His source didn't have any more information than that, but he was working on it. Tretyakov was not surprised. There had been three attacks on NATO personnel up to this point. Per his instructions, the People's Revolutionary Front had taken credit for each one. He wanted NATO chasing the organization down, wasting its time and energy, racking up bad press at every possible turn. What he needed to be careful about, though, was NATO making too much progress too quickly. In the case of Norway, he had many questions. How had the authorities uncovered the cell? Had they done it on their own? Did they have help? And if they did have help, where did that help come from? NATO? The Americans? Finally, was there anything in Norway that could lead to the other PRF cells that had not yet been deployed? There were countless moving parts, but that's where Tretyakov excelled. His brain was incredibly flexible, and its gears moved smoothly in concert with each other. That was until now, which was why he needed to escape the cacophony of his office. Exiting the building, he walked down the broad Leninsky Prospect toward the Pregola River. It was cold, the sky overhead steel gray. Snow was predicted soon. He turned the collar of his leather jacket up against the chill. As he moved down the sidewalk, his dark, narrow eyes swept from side to side, taking everything in. He had been in the intelligence game for decades, and there were certain habits that you never lost, even on your home turf. He kept his dark, receding hair cut short, not military short, but rather businessman short. When he traveled from country to country on a range of different passports, businessman was his preferred cover. For a man of 52, he was in decent shape. He ran and did calisthenics almost daily. Like most Russians, he was a drinker, but unlike so many of his countrymen, he didn't drink to excess. He rarely drank in public and almost never with his colleagues or subordinates, unless he was trying to get one of them drunk so he could squeeze information out of them. When he drank, it was solely to unwind, and he always knew when he'd had enough. Alcoholism was rampant in the Russian military. It was such a problem that soldiers' field rations even included small bottles of vodka. He saw it within the GRU as well. Empty bottles could be found on windowsills and toilet tanks in every men's room. No doubt many full or half-full bottles were hidden away in desk drawers throughout the building as well. It was a national sickness, the means by which the masses numbed themselves while the politicians and oligarchs avoided having to answer for the people's shitty existence. Russia was better than this. His countrymen had lost their pride. The USSR had been a global superpower. It had demanded respect on the world stage. It had launched the first Earth-orbiting satellite, had put the first man into space, as well as the first modular space station. It had introduced the world's first regional jet, and had invented the first artificial heart. It had carried out the first heart transplant, the first lung transplant, and the first liver transplant. It had grown to be the world's second largest overall economy. As far as Tretyakov was concerned, Russia would not only be great again, it would be united again. And for that to happen, every Russian had to do his or her part. Tretyakov was committed to doing his. Taking the long way around, he crossed the short honeymoon bridge where newlyweds came for photos and to fasten a padlock to the railing symbolizing their undying love. Tretyakov was no romantic. He was a realist and found the practice ridiculous. There had to be thousands of rusting locks along both sides of the bridge. He could only imagine the weight it added. It was a trend he saw repeated throughout cities in Russia and across Europe. Before World War II, the city of Kaliningrad had been the German city of Königsberg. The Soviets annexed what was left of it in 1945 and gave it its new name in 1946. The 25-acre island on the other side of Honeymoon Bridge was known as Nipoff Island, home of the Königsberg Cathedral. It was also the final resting place of the philosopher Immanuel Kant. Tretyakov had always found the island's walking paths, as well as its quiet cathedral, good places to collect his thoughts. The fact that Kant was entombed there was a bonus. Marxism, the philosophy of the Soviet Union, was built upon Kant's work, which only made it feel more special. Crossing the bridge, a sense of calm usually befell him, as if magically his troubles couldn't follow him onto the island. Today, though, that wasn't the case. With each step he had taken since leaving his office, his problems, like the locks, had only weighed heavier upon him. In addition to wanting a full report, his superiors were considering moving up his timetable. They were concerned over two pieces of intelligence that had recently come in. One was about an odd meeting that was observed at the United Nations in New York City. It had involved the U.S. ambassador, as well as the ambassadors to Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. No one knew precisely what to make of it until another piece of intelligence had come in. A small U.S. military convoy leaving Poland for the very same Baltic nations had been robbed. Allegedly, the cargo that had been stolen included upgrade kits for land-based, incredibly hard-to-defeat Griffin cruise missiles. These were the same missiles that had been banned under a previous treaty between Russia and the United States. None of them should have existed, much less have been in Europe. Even more troubling was the fact that Griffin missiles were capable of carrying nuclear warheads. According to one of their Polish spies, a covert Polish intelligence team had been tasked with trying to recover the stolen upgrade kits. If the intelligence was accurate, and he had no reason to doubt it, the missiles represented a significant obstacle to the invasion. It was no wonder his superiors were nervous. Their entire calculus could very well be in jeopardy. But if they were thinking of beating the upgraded missiles to the battlefield by accelerating his timetable, such a move wasn't without risk. It was when one sped up operations that mistakes happened, often deadly mistakes, and he felt certain that would be the case here. It was a recipe for potential disaster. Nevertheless, he was a soldier. It was his job to follow orders, not question them, no matter how poorly conceived he believed them to be. If headquarters wanted to accelerate the timeline, he would do what they commanded. There would be consequences, though. Of that, he was sure. And he had a pretty good idea of where some of the worst might take place. Removing his encrypted cell phone, he began to compose a message. The cell in Sweden needed to be warned. Chapter 18. Brussels South Airport, Belgium. The prospect of flying back to Scandinavia, especially on another military transport, wasn't very appealing to Jasinski. On the plus side, though, at least the flight would be short, less than 2 hours. After thanking Nicholas for lunch, Harvath had driven her back to shape. On the way, she had asked again why they were going to Gotland. Harvath told her he would explain once they were in the air. Dropping her at the front gate, he instructed her to pack a bag and meet him at Brussels South Airport at 7 p.m. When she arrived at the address he had given her, she was shown through the lobby of a fixed base operator and escorted outside. There, standing on the tarmac beside a sleek white business jet with gray pinstriping, was Harvath. He had his back to her and was sipping from a styrofoam cup of hot coffee as he admired the aircraft. "Nice ride," she shouted, loud enough to be heard over a commercial aircraft taking off nearby. "Gulfstream G650? Harvath was impressed.
"G650ER," he clarified, turning to greet her. "Extended range package, 7,500 nautical miles, sleeps 10, can travel at Mach 0.90, has a kick-ass espresso maker, and comes with cup holders and free Wi-Fi."
"How'd you swing this?"
"Like I said, if it flies, floats, or fights, I'm your guy."
Apparently, Jasinski agreed, as the co-pilot approached, politely took her bag, and added it to a stack of much bigger luggage near the tail. Much of it was hard-sided plastic storm cases. She could only imagine what was inside. She doubted they were full of toothpaste, razor blades, and clean underwear. Looking back at Harvath, she asked,
"How long are we planning on being away?"
"Those belong to the rest of the team."
"Team?"
"They're already on board. I'll introduce you."
Harvath led the way up the air stairs and into the cabin of the G650ER. The first thing she noticed was how luxurious it was. The white leather seats were trimmed with gray piping and had individual controls for heating and cooling. The tables were crafted from highly polished Macassar ebony veneers. Plush gray carpeting with a swirling black design ran end to end. The fixtures were polished nickel. It even had the new plane smell. Scattered throughout the cabin in various stages of shoes-off, feet-up relaxation were four men and one woman who made up the team. Leaning in close to her, Harvath confided,
"They still refuse to wear name tags, so I'm probably going to get a few of these wrong."
Straightening up, he pointed as he worked his way down the aisle and said,
"You've already met Gage, Morrison, and Nicholas, who are holding down the fort back at HQ, so let me introduce the rest of the team. Everyone, this is Monica Jasinski. Monica, this is Gimpy, Grumpy, Dopey, Drippy, and Sparkle."
Each of the passengers held up a middle finger in response. Some of them held up two.
"Be especially nice to Sparkle," Harvath added. "The entire cabin lights, music, temperature runs on an app, and she's the only one who's been able to figure it out."
Rolling her eyes, the woman Harvath had identified as Sparkle stood up, came forward, and introduced herself.
"Nice to meet you, Monica. I'm Sloane Ashby."
She was a very attractive woman. In her late 20s, she had blonde hair, smoky gray eyes, and distinctly high cheekbones.
"It's a pleasure to meet you," Monica said, shaking Sloane's hand. If you haven't figured it out yet, Harvath's superpower is being a smartass.
It's pronounced jackass, someone yelled from the back.
Sloan chuckled and continued.
So, like I said, I'm Sloan. Let me introduce you to everyone else.
Gesturing with her hands as if she was giving an airplane safety demonstration, she pointed to each team member and gave their real name and background as they walked down the aisle. Each stood and politely shook her hand as they were introduced.
First up, said Sloan, Mike Haney, USMC Force Recon.
Pleased to meet you, the 6-foot-tall, 40-year-old Marin, California native said.
Next, Tim Barton, U.S. Navy SEALs, DevGru.
The stocky fireplug of a man was in his early 30s. Despite only standing about 5'6", he looked tough as hell. He had reddish-blonde hair and a full beard to match.
Then we have Tyler Stalen, Combat Applications Group, or simply CAG, which used to be called Delta Force, but is still referred to as the Unit, I think. I can't be sure.
There may have already been another name change since we got on the plane. The 39-year-old from downstate Illinois smiled as he shook her hand. He stood 5'10" and had a book on the table in front of his seat called Beirut Rules by Fred Burton.
I've heard of that book, said Yashinsky. Is it any good?
That bearded refrigerator you met earlier today gave it to me, he replied. I'm only a couple of chapters in, but so far it's excellent.
I'll make sure to add it to my list. Thank you.
Stalen smiled again and sat back down as Sloan introduced Monica to the plane's final passenger.
And last but not least, she said, we have Chase Palmer, also of Combat Applications Group, Delta Force, or whatever they're calling themselves over the next half hour.
You forgot handsome, Palmer stated, his voice identifying him as the one who had called Harvath a jackass. He was in his early 30s and actually looked so similar to Harvath that the two could have passed for brothers.
And what's your background? Yashinsky asked, once Sloane Ashby had finished the introductions. U.S. Army, THTH, she replied. THTH? Too hot to handle, Sloane explained. The first soldier to ever be pulled from combat for being too damn good at her job.
You mean killing as many of the enemy as possible?
That's what I thought I'd signed up for. But being a woman in a...
Long story, Harvath said, peeling Yashinsky away from Sloan and steering her toward a seat near his up front.
Do you want anything before we take off? Can I get a water?
Sure. Walking to the rear of the cabin, he pulled a bottle from the galley fridge, prepared another espresso, and returned as the jet began to taxi to the runway.
Here you go, he said, as he handed the water to her. Thank you, she replied.
Sitting down across from her, he placed his espresso atop the table between their seats and asked to see her cell phone.
Why? I'm going to give you a superpower of your own.
Smartass? She asked, handing it over to him. From what I hear, I'm already okay in that department.
Removing a small piece of metal from his pocket, he popped open the cover for her SIM card and replied,
No. Invisibility.
It only took him a couple of seconds to swap out her card and replace it with a brand new one that didn't have a history and couldn't be traced back to them.
There you go,
he said, closing everything up and returning her phone.
What about my original SIM card?
We'll all swap back when we're in the air on the way home.
It seemed to her a pretty elaborate precaution, one that you would take only if you were doing something you shouldn't be.
The Swedes know we're coming, right?
He took a moment before answering, and when he did, it was his pause, not his words, that unnerved her. Chapter 19. As the twin Rolls-Royce BR-725 engines roared to life, and the G-650ER began to race down the runway, Yashinsky tried to get clarification.
Either they know, or they don't know. Which one is it?
Harvath picked up his espresso and settled back in his seat.
Like I said, the appropriate agency has been made aware.
What does that mean?
It means they know.
Yashinsky doubted that's what it meant, but she let it go and changed the subject.
Why Sweden?
She asked as the jet lifted off. technically they're not a NATO member.
Correct, he replied, but they're a NATO affiliate. They're also strategically important. In particular, Gotland is very important. If the Russians want to take and hold the Baltics, they have to control the Baltic Sea. To do that, they need the Swedish island of Gotland. It's small, which means a large invasion force isn't necessary, and its position near the middle of the Baltic Sea would allow Russia to prevent any NATO ships from reinforcing Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. If they control Gotland, they control everything.
But I thought Sweden was already handling concerns over Russia. Didn't they bring back conscription?
They did. They have even permanently garrisoned several hundred soldiers on the island, but it isn't nearly enough. 3 years ago, 33,000 Russian troops rehearsed an invasion of Sweden. Gotland fell in less than an hour.
So, if Gotland is so important, why hasn't more been done about it? She asked.
The Swedes have pumped a lot of money into infrastructure, said Harbath. But infrastructure isn't their main problem. Troop strength is. We've been working with them, conducting joint training exercises and encouraging them to build up their forces on the island, but they simply don't have enough soldiers to go around.
So what happens if Russia invades?
The Swedes think they can move troops in from the mainland.
In under an hour? You can't even mobilize, much less move troops in under an hour.
That's what we're worried about. There's a concern the Swedes might not even defend Gotland at all. They might choose to focus their resources on Stockholm and other key areas, in hopes of limiting the invasion, and holding out until the United States and other NATO members come to their aid.
By which time, control of the Baltic Sea will have already been ceded to the Russians, giving them exactly what they want.
Harbath nodded solemnly. Swedish politicians may not think they fully need NATO, but NATO absolutely needs Sweden if it wants to protect the Baltic states. That's why Russians can't be allowed to take Gotland.
I still don't understand why Sweden hasn't joined NATO yet.
Russia has made it very clear that if Sweden does, it will be seen as an act of aggression against them.
So?
So I think Sweden is spooked. They're trying to remain neutral if they can and thread the needle in order to hopefully have their cake and eat it too.
Sounds like a pretty dangerous gamble to me.
Harvath nodded again.
Believe me, we agree. If war broke out with Russia, we couldn't afford to have our forces divided, fighting on both sides of the Baltic.
Suppose the Russians did seal off the Baltic. Then what?
To get to any of the Baltic states, NATO's ground forces would have to move up through Poland. Normally, most of the equipment would be put on trains. There's just one problem. Western Europe adheres to a standard gauge. Once you leave Poland and head up into Lithuania, the width of the tracks change. It's a logistics nightmare.
Not to mention the transition points being prime targets for sabotage.
Exactly, replied Harbath. We're looking at weeks, possibly even a month, before an effective response to a Russian invasion of the Baltics could be launched.
During which time, Lithuanian, Latvian, and Estonian forces would be cut to ribbons. Russian forces would have ample time to fortify their positions, dig in, and prepare for any NATO attack.
Along with the additional troops NATO rotates through the Baltic states, as well as the standby force it maintains in Poland.
But what about air support? She asked. Couldn't Allied aircraft launch from Sweden or Finland?
Depends on whether they grant us permission, or whether they play the neutrality card and stay out of it. Finland, as you know, isn't a member of NATO either. The U.S. has been doing a lot of training with them, weapon sales and things like that, but until bullets start flying, you never really know what people are going to do. What's more, NATO air superiority isn't guaranteed. Russian attack fighters and anti-aircraft systems could make it very difficult for our pilots.
Sounds pretty dire.
I deal in worst-case scenarios. Like I said, my job is to prevent an Article 5 from happening.
So why are we going to Sweden?
Harvath took a sip of his espresso.
To see a man in a hat.
Yashinsky looked down the length of the luxury plane, studying all the players assembled aboard.
Must be one hell of a hat.
Second best thing to ever come out of Sweden.
Really? What's the first? And don't say ABBA.
Okay, I won't. The NATO investigator smiled.
Seriously.
What's in Sweden besides this man in a hat?
Harvath took another sip of espresso. Nicholas cracked three of the phones from the cabin in Norway. They led us to a person of interest on Gotland. We have a contact in Swedish intelligence. He's been running it to ground for us.
Is that what Nicholas meant by Sweden might hold very serious trouble?
He has a lot of history with the Russians. He doesn't think they'd waste an anti-NATO cell there. What he does think is that they might place a deep-cover Spetsnaz team, highly trained in reconnaissance and sabotage, to harass and tie up Swedish troops during a Russian invasion.
What do you think?
I think it could go either way. But regardless, we need to find out.
Is that what all the storm cases are about? She asked. What's inside them?
Harvath winked at her.
Pens, pencils, paper, that sort of thing.
This is a fact-finding trip. We're just here to learn.
Right.
She laughed.
And I've got a big, beautiful bridge to sell you in San Francisco.
Too dangerous.
Bridges?
No. San Francisco, he replied. She laughed again. He smiled back. Slowly he was winning her over. That was important because he needed her. In truth, he needed 100 more like her. 1,000. The threats faced by Western Europe were rapidly changing, evolving. Unfortunately, Western Europe wasn't. By not leaning in, by not being aggressive, they were encouraging more acts of violence upon their nations and their citizens. They had forgotten that civilization lives, thrives, and survives only when it is willing to wield a very sharp sword. If you didn't meet the barbarians out on the road, soon they'd be at your gates. And once at your gates, be they Islamic terrorists or Russian soldiers, they would soon be inside. Simply put, Western Europe's enemies did not fear them. They did not fear them because they did not respect them. And they did not respect them because the Western Europeans would not fight. The Europeans, like any noble society, prided themselves upon what set them apart, what made them better than the barbarians, their laws. The barbarians didn't care for laws. They only cared for brute force. What can I take? Whom can I subjugate? What can I make mine through sheer force of will? Law and civilization were supremely important things, but without strength and a willingness to engage the enemy, they were worthless. Harvath had always appreciated the maxim of an army lieutenant colonel named David Grossman. In Grossman's mind, there were just three categories of human beings: sheep, sheepdogs, and wolves. To those three categories, Harvath added another: wolf hunters. That was what the world needed more of. The sheep had only two speeds, graze and stampede. They needed sheepdogs to keep them safe in case of an attack by the wolves. Wolf hunters, though, were needed to find and kill the wolves, whenever possible, before they attacked. Harvath was a wolf hunter. His whole team was composed of wolf hunters. He saw the potential for Yashinsky to be one, too. That's why it was important that she experience what they did and understand why they were necessary. He and his team couldn't be everywhere. There were too many hotspots, too many threats. But when they did appear, only for the most serious of threats, they acted as a force multiplier. And in those situations, like now, the more wolf hunters they helped create, the more endangered the wolves became, and the safer the places the hunters protected.
So, she said, breaking into his thoughts, what do I need to know before we land?
Harvath thought about it for a moment.
You're with an exceptional team that's on the right side of this fight, he replied. No matter what happens, just remember that.
Chapter 20. Gotland, Sweden. They landed at Visby Airport on the west side of the island. Seeing the town's name emblazoned upon one of the hangars, Yashinsky said, "Visby's an interesting name. I wonder where it comes from."
"It's Old Norse," Harvath replied. "It means the pagan place of sacrifices."
"Seriously?"
"Seriously."
"What a delightful omen," she stated.
Harvath grinned. At 100 miles long and 30 miles wide, Gotland was Sweden's largest island and was known as the Pearl of the Baltic. It lay 90 miles from the mainland and was home to 60,000 inhabitants, 23,000 of whom lived in the main town of Visby. Surrounded by the Baltic Sea, its coasts were craggy and windswept, covered with limestone pebbles, while its interior boasted lush pine forests, dramatic grass marshes, sprawling meadows, and fertile, verdant farmland. As the jet rolled to a stop, a private aviation ground crew materialized and laid down a red carpet. Looking out the window, Harvath didn't see his contact. What he did see were two uniformed police officers, one tall, one short, along with a man in a leather coat, exiting the FBO building and walking in the direction of their plane.
"What's going on?" Yashinsky asked, as she looked out the window at the men who were approaching.
Picking up his cell phone, he dialed the man in the hat. It went immediately to voicemail. He tried again with the same result.
"Do me a favor," he said,
pulling out his Sig Sauer and handing it to her.
"Hold this for me until I get back."
"What's up?" Sloane asked from the back. Chase, who could see the cops approaching through his window, said,
"Karma. I got $100 says that Harvath dated at least one of their daughters."
"Time to face the music, Norseman," Barton joked.
Harvath ignored them as he grabbed his North Face jacket and moved forward. Sticking his head in the cockpit, he told the pilots,
"Keep the engines hot."
Then he disarmed the forward door, opened it up, and extended the air stairs. They hit dead center at the top of the red carpet. The chilly, salt-tinged ocean air blew through the open doorway. As he zipped up his jacket and prepared to walk down to speak with the men, Yashinsky changed seats so she could get a better view of what was happening. Sloane came up and joined her.
"Any idea what this is all about?"
the NATO investigator asked again.
"I don't know," Sloane replied.
"The man in the hat was supposed to meet us. Apparently, he's not here."
"Why do you keep calling him that? Doesn't he have a name?"
Sloane smiled.
"Lars Lund. He works for Sweden's Military Intelligence and Security Service."
"Must," Yashinsky replied, using its acronym. Part of the Swedish Armed Forces, MUST was the country's main foreign intelligence service and reported to both the government and the military. Sloane nodded.
"Lars is known for his good looks, tall, blonde, and Nordic, but he is even better known for his vanity. When he started to go bald, his friends began buying him hats. His trademark is one of those small alpine-style caps made out of felt."
"A Tyrolean?"
"That's the one. He has all kinds of them."
"Which division of MUST is he from?" Yashinsky asked.
"Now you're going to stump me," Sloane replied. "I'm not up to speed on all the acronyms yet."
"It's okay. What does he specialize in?"
"Espionage and clandestine operations."
"He's probably in KSI then."
"That's the one," said Sloane.
Also known as the Office for Special Assignment, KSI was the darkest corner of Swedish intelligence. In all of the country's civil law system, there was only one mention of it. Yashinsky was intrigued.
"How is it you know him?" she asked.
"I don't. Not personally. I only know of him. He and my boss go way back together."
"Lars and Harvath do?"
Sloane smiled.
"I should rephrase that. Lars and my boss's boss go way back."
"And who's your boss's boss?"
Sloane smiled once more.
"Now we're getting into things above my pay grade."
"So you're not going to tell me?"
"It's better if you ask Harvath,"
she replied, as she glanced back out the window. Yashinsky realized that she had likely hit a dead end. Changing the subject, she too looked out the window and asked,
"Are we in trouble?"
"Only if they search our luggage."
"Shit," Yashinsky mumbled under her breath.
"And knowing Harvath," Sloane continued, "he probably did date one of their daughters, so we're probably totally screwed."
The joke made her smile.
"Where'd he get the Norseman call sign?"
"In the SEALs. He had a thing for flight attendants from Scandinavian Airlines. Dated quite a few of them. The name started as a joke, but stuck.
And now?
Meaning what? Sloane replied. Is he dating? Married?
Yashinsky nodded.
Sloane grinned.
Yeah. His friends refer to her as the underwear model. Her parents are from Brazil. She's gorgeous, super smart, tough as hell, and really sweet.
Why? You're not interested in him, are you?
Me?
Yashinsky scoffed.
No, not at all. Just curious.
She's a liar, and not a very good one, Sloane thought. But better for her to know up front. Harvath was as close to marriage as you could get without actually being married. The joke around the Carlton group was that if he ever came back home long enough for there to be a wedding, he'd probably be married already. As far as Sloane was concerned, Harvath would be an idiot not to marry Lara. They were made for each other. She'd never seen two people click as well as those two. But what truly amazed her was how Harvath could put his entire personal life in a box, slam the lid shut, and not let it intrude on his thinking while he was downrange on a mission. He had an iron will. It was the only way she could describe it. Only half-joking, she had teased that she hoped to grow up and be just like him one day. She made a lot of jokes at Harvath's expense, especially about his being older, but he took them all in stride. He was like the older brother she never had. Harvath made his share of jokes at her expense as well. One of his favorites was that she was just young enough and good-looking enough to be a rich country club doctor's perfect idea of a third wife. That had cracked Sloane up. Outside their age difference, she and Harvath were very similar personality-wise. Both had been accomplished winter athletes before joining the military. They were also hard chargers who employed a lot of take-no-prisoners humor to buoy morale in order to get through tough assignments, as well as just the day-to-day. It had always impressed her that he had never come on to her. Many men, even in leadership positions, had, but not him. It was one of the many reasons she respected him.
"I have it on good authority," Sloane joked, "that he sleeps with a light on and leaves the toilet seat up. You can do better. Much better. Believe me."
Yashinsky laughed and tried to appear blasé. He was off the market. His teammates liked his significant other, and apparently the two were a good match. She had been foolish to allow her mind to even explore the possibility. You got one really good chance in life, and she'd had hers. It had been wonderful while it lasted. That kind of person didn't come around twice. She consoled herself with the thought that at least she had her work. Concentrating on the scene unfolding outside, the two watched as Harvath descended the air stairs and approached the man in the leather coat flanked by the pair of police officers. Despite the jokes that had been made at Harvath's expense, suddenly, the situation didn't seem funny anymore. Chapter 21. Halogen lights illuminated the revetment area. The man in the leather coat had stepped away from the uniformed officers and was making his way forward. He met Harvath halfway across the tarmac. Removing a set of credentials, he held them up and asked, "Pratar du svenska?" "Do you speak Swedish?" Harvath shook his head.
"English."
The majority of Swedes were bilingual, and the man seamlessly switched over.
"My name is Chief Inspector Anders Nyström, Swedish Police, Gotland."
Nyström was thin, like a distance runner, and stood about 5'8". He had a head of short blonde hair and a closely cropped blonde beard, both shot through with streaks of gray. He wore a trendy pair of glasses, behind which a pair of green eyes took everything in. On his right wrist was a large digital watch. Harvath knew that in any encounter with law enforcement, the first test was the attitude test. If you failed the attitude test, everything went downhill from there. Smiling, he extended his hand and replied,
"Nice to meet you. Is everything okay?"
"That depends," said Nyström. "May I ask your name, please?"
Harvath didn't want to give this guy anything. The man in the hat had not only failed to meet their plane, but had also failed to answer his phone. Something was wrong.
and until Harvath knew what was going on, he was going to be very careful about what he revealed.
My name is Stephen Hall.
The Hall alias was one Harvath had created in honor of a courageous OSS member who had been murdered by the Nazis.
May I see some identification, please? The chief inspector requested.
I'm sorry, said Harvath. Did we come in on the wrong runway or something?
No, nothing like that.
Having come from Belgium to Sweden, this was an inter-European Union flight. That meant no border controls, passport checks, or customs inspections. Being met by national police like this was highly unusual. Harvath removed his own set of credentials, which had been fabricated for him back in Virginia, and showed them to the officer.
NATO, the man remarked as he examined them. Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe.
Interesting. What is your purpose in Sweden?
I collect ABBA memorabilia.
The joke made the chief inspector chuckle.
I see. Can you please tell me what this is all about? You're obviously here for a reason, Harvath said.
I was hoping you could tell me. There was a car accident tonight. The driver was carrying a piece of notebook paper with the Visby airport code, a time of arrival, and the tail number for your aircraft. I assume the driver was on his way here to meet you.
A bad feeling began to build in the pit of Harvath's stomach.
Is the driver okay?
Unfortunately, no. He was killed in the accident.
Have you identified him?
Nystrom nodded.
And? Asked Harvath.
First, please tell me, were you expecting someone to meet you here tonight? And if so, whom? Their name.
Lars Lund, said Harvath,
the feeling in his stomach climbing into his throat.
I'm sorry to inform you that Mr. Lund died this evening as a result of the injuries he suffered.
Harvath masked his feelings. He was highly skeptical of car accidents, especially when they involve skilled intelligence operatives in the middle of assignments. He felt the same way about plane crashes and hit and runs. Experienced people in the espionage game tended to be very careful. As a rule, they checked and then double-checked everything. They didn't take unnecessary risks. When they did end up the victim of an accident, foul play always had to be considered.
What can you tell me about it? Harvath asked.
From what we can surmise, Mr. Lund was traveling at a high rate of speed and lost control, said the officer. Is there any reason why he may have been in such a hurry?
Harvath shrugged.
None that I can think of.
Exactly why was Mr. Lund coming to meet you?
He was supposed to have been our host.
Host for what? Asked Nystrom.
Mr. Lund worked for the Swedish Defense Force back in Stockholm. We were going to tour the island with him and discuss logistics for an upcoming multilateral training exercise.
Harvath knew that Swedish authorities, particularly those on Gotland, were alert to potential Russian infiltration. At the same time, they had also become increasingly accustomed to military training exercises with NATO. That meant the closer he stuck to the truth of why he and his team were here, the less chance their presence would raise any alarm.
Can you tell me more about this exercise? The chief inspector inquired.
Unfortunately, not without approval from higher up. What I can say is that it's an unannounced drill designed to test joint readiness. Participants, including the garrison here on Gotland, would be given a scenario and then be graded on how quickly they mobilized and how well they responded.
So the exercise is a secret.
That's a good word for it, but I think surprise would be more accurate.
By surprising them and not giving them time to prepare, we're better able to measure how they would react in real life.
Nystrom seemed to buy it and handed Harvath his credentials back.
Should I not alert the garrison commander about claiming the body then? He asked. Harvath had to think quickly.
That should probably be up to the Swedish armed forces. It's their choice if they want to inform the garrison commander or not. They might decide to send someone from Stockholm to quietly claim the body.
Indeed, replied the chief inspector. Speaking of which, did you know Mr. Lund personally?
I did.
As he's from the mainland, we don't have anyone on Gotland to confirm his identity. Would you be willing to come with me to the hospital?
Now?
Yes, said Nystrom, if it's not too much trouble.
Of course, replied Harvath. Give me a couple of minutes to inform my colleagues inside the plane about what has happened.
Absolutely. Take your time.
What's the story, boss? Haney asked as Harvath came back aboard the aircraft.
The team had all assembled up front as they watched the conversation unfolding on the tarmac.
Allegedly, said Harvath, the man in the hat was involved in a car accident tonight. According to the police, he died of injuries sustained in the crash.
A silence fell over the plane.
They have asked me to go to the hospital with them and identify the body.
Bad idea, stated Stalin.
Agreed, replied Chase. On the way to meet us, the man in the hat dies in a car crash. Now three strangers show up and want you to drive off someplace with them? How do we even know they're real cops?
I don't like it, added Sloan.
I don't like it either, Harvath responded. But I want to confirm the body is Lund's. If this is legit, we might need the local police.
And if it's not legit? Yashinsky asked.
Then make sure Nicholas gets all my vinyl.
She rolled her eyes.
Relax, he continued. Everything is going to be fine. But, in case it isn't, I'd like to have my SIG with me.
Good call,
she said, handing his pistol back to him.
Let's find room for this, too, said Haney, holding up a small GPS tracking device and tossing it to him.
Harvath tucked it in his pocket.
The man in the hat was supposed to hook us up with vehicles. How are we going to follow you? Sloan asked.
If worst comes to worst, Gotland has Uber. We're only a few kilometers from the city center, so there should be plenty, replied Harvath. For now, though, I want you to send Ryan an update on our situation and have her reach out to Carl Pedersen. He has some good contacts in Must and knows what's at stake. He'll help put a lid on this. Chase, I want you to deplane and see if you can secure a courtesy car from the FBO. Barton, we're going to need at least two permanent vehicles while we're here, so check what the airport rental agencies have and try to nail something down. Haney, no one touches our gear but you. It stays on board this plane until you're sure the police are gone. In the meantime, Stalin, I want you to figure out where we're going to bunk.
How long do you think we're going to be here? He asked.
As long as it takes, Harvath stated. Okay, that's it. Everybody get to work. Let's go.
While the team jumped up to do as he had directed, Yashinsky stopped him.
Sloan explained to me that Lund was close to Pedersen and your boss. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you. He was one of the good guys. Took a lot of risks over the years. Those risks made a difference.
Does Must really know we're here? Or was Lars Lund the only one who knew?
Harvath wasn't sure how he wanted to answer her question, but decided to tell her the truth.
Lars was the only one who knew we were coming. I doubt he shared it with anyone else.
That makes what we're doing, what you're doing, even more dangerous.
Placing her hand gently on his shoulder, she warned,
"Be careful."
Chapter 22. Harvath carried his Sig Sauer in a neoprene sticky brand holster, tucked inside his waistband at the small of his back. It was uncomfortable, and he wanted to adjust it. He didn't dare to, though, for fear of tipping off Nystrom that he was armed. Instead, he tried to focus on the sights and sounds of Visby by night. It was a medieval city that functioned as the island's capital. A UNESCO World Heritage Site, it was the best-preserved fortified commercial city in northern Europe. Its old town looked like something out of a movie. Strung with painted cottages, cobblestone lanes, and the ruins of Romanesque and Gothic churches, its most dramatic features were the largely intact 13th-century ramparts surrounding it. Harvath could only imagine what a draw it was at the height of summer. Right now, on a Friday night off-season, it was still doing very well. Bars, restaurants, and cafes conducted a brisk business. People walked up and down the sidewalks, and there was plenty of car and bus traffic. As the chief inspector slowed down to allow a group of pedestrians to cross up ahead, Harvath asked,
"What more can you tell me about the accident?"
"Not much,"
It happened in the countryside about 30 kilometers outside of town. Based on the tire marks, we believed Mr. Lund was traveling in excess of 120 kilometers an hour. The speed limit in that area is only 70. Mr. Lund appeared to have lost control of his vehicle, whereupon the vehicle left the roadway, rolled, and hit a tree. He was pronounced dead at the scene.
Who reported the accident?
Harvath asked. A passing motorist saw taillights in the brush, stopped to investigate, and then called police.
Do you see a lot of vehicular fatalities on Gotland?
Nystrom shook his head. They are very rare, but when they do happen, the victims are usually holidaymakers and alcohol is involved. Was Mr. Lund a drinker?
Not that I'm aware of, replied Harvath.
Any medications?
I have no idea.
That's okay, said the chief inspector. They will do a toxicology screen at the hospital.
Any evidence that Lund may have been forced off the road?
The Swede thought about it for a moment.
Forced? Why do you ask?
Are you aware of someone who wished him harm?
Harvath shook his head. Just wondering.
Perhaps he swerved to avoid an animal? Gotland is predominantly rural, and roe deer are a real hazard throughout the island.
Was there any unusual damage to Lund's vehicle? Anything that would suggest he came in contact with a deer, or anything else?
The car was very badly damaged. If there was such evidence, it would be incredibly difficult to ascertain. Have you much experience with automobile accidents, Mr. Harvath?
Some, he replied. Where is Lund's car now?
Nystrom looked at the clock on his dashboard. A wrecker was dispatched to retrieve it. It will be kept at the wrecking company's lot while we finish the paperwork and file our initial findings. Sometimes, if a claim is filed, an insurance representative will come out from Stockholm. They may conduct their own investigation. When that's complete, the car will be released.
And then?
In a case like this, where the vehicle is unsalvageable, it is sold for scrap. It will be loaded on the car ferry back to the mainland and disposed of there.
I'd like to see the vehicle myself. Would that be possible?
Harvath inquired. I suppose something could be arranged, said Nystrom. But I must ask, what is your interest in viewing it? Are you looking for something, something you think my team may have missed?
I'm sure your team did an excellent job. I only asked because my superior was quite fond of Mr. Lund. They were friends, as well as colleagues. He will be glad to know that I took an additional look.
You said you had some experience with automobile accidents. Were you a police officer previously?
In a prior career, I was a federal law enforcement officer.
The chief inspector knew a thing or two about American law enforcement. Judging by the look of his passenger, he asked, U.S. Marshals?
Secret Service, Harvath replied. Like I said, my superior will be happy just to know I took a look.
So this is a request cop to cop, as you Americans say. Harvath nodded.
A professional courtesy. Cop to cop.
Up ahead was a sign for the Visby Hospital. Nystrom applied his turn signal and turned down a narrow residential street. Beyond, Harvath could already see the lights of the parking lot. When they pulled in, the chief inspector found a space near the emergency room entrance and parked. The hospital was much bigger than Harvath had expected. It was a sprawling three-story complex built of orange brick overlooking the ocean. The pale green of its multiple rooftops was echoed in the pale green of the window mullions. Harvath noticed a windsock, which told him there was a helipad nearby as well. Entering the ER, they approached an intake desk, staffed by a pretty young nurse with spiky red hair, who knew Nystrom on sight. After a friendly back and forth, she laughed and waved the police officer and his guest past.
"Friend of yours?"
Harvath asked as they walked down the hall. We're in a local trail running club together, on Facebook, the Swede replied. She was teasing me about my recent time. She says that if they released criminals on the trails, maybe I would run faster.
And what did you say back that made her laugh?
I told her that I would definitely run faster if they released redheads. Harvath grinned.
Good line.
He had been right about the chief inspector being a runner. Approaching a bank of elevators, Nystrom reached out and pressed the down button. When an elevator arrived, they stepped inside and rode it to the basement. As soon as the doors opened, Harvath got a blast of one of his least favorite smells. morgues had a very distinct odor. No matter how far the actual room was from the elevators or a stairwell, the minute he arrived on the same floor, he knew it. There was no disguising the scent. "I assume you're familiar with the identification process," the chief inspector added. Harbath nodded. He'd been through the process before. Walking into the morgue, Nystrom paused briefly to chat with one of the technicians. Once the discussion was complete, he led them to an autopsy table.